Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Happy Mojo Monday, everyone.
Happy Mojo Monday.
Good morning.
Good morning. We had a little technical issue getting us started this morning, but Mercury retrograde. How's everybody doing today?
Doing great.
Great.
Awesome. It's great to have you with us today, Scott.
Thank you for having me back.
Absolutely. That was a blessing. And why don't we get started just doing a nice meditation to get things going and connected, and then we're talking about our awesome topic that we have today. I'm really excited about it. So let's just get a little comfortable and relaxed wherever you are and take some nice cleansing breaths, whatever's natural for you. Just allow that energy to flow into your body and get into a nice rhythm with your breathing in your center. And as you're breathing, feel that center increasing in your heart, in your heart space. Your conscious breathing into your heart. And connect to that peace and that tranquility with each breath coming out of your heart. Feel the vibrations of unconditional love. Wholeness. Peace. Joy. Happiness. Let these feelings and vibrations fill your entire body. And expanding out even farther with each breath into your energy field. All around you. Now with this next breath, imagine a beautiful pink, vibrant light in your heart center. With beautiful flashes of emerald green in this light. With each breath, feel it increasing, filling your body and every cell with this beautiful pink and green light. With each breath, feel it sparkling and becoming even more dazzling and beautiful. And also see that glowing and expanding into your energy field. All around you. Do you feel yourself sitting in this beautiful ball of energy, this beautiful pink and green light? When you really feel this vibration and this strength, I want you to think of some situations in your life or people or person that could use this energy and this light. And I'd like you to imagine them sitting next to you and you encompassing them in this light as well. Let your light grow so big and so vast that it can fit them. And see their peace and feel their peace and their love and their joy. With each breath, they're covered with this beautiful light and love. Now, if you will, imagine anyone that you think may need this light. Or or any institution, if it is a country, imagine putting this light all around them. Filling their worlds and their life and their loved ones with this beautiful light and energy. With each breath, be confident in that connection and that ability to shine that light and that love to anyone in your life at any time. And now as we all breathe together, I'd like us to imagine surrounding the entire earth in this beautiful green and pink light. That we're consciously covering every person and our entire earth in this beautiful light of love and healing. That everyone together can be taking this conscious breath of love and light. And then I'd like you to begin to breathe back into your own heart space and come back to your body. And I'd like us all to remember that throughout our day, at any time, we can consciously breathe this energy and this light into our own bodies and our own energies and also out into anyone in this world. Shining and sharing this love and this light and this healing with all people in our one connection of unity and love. Namaste.
That was beautiful.
That was beautiful.
Thank you, guys. It's always amazing to start our week off together. Another beautiful Mojo Monday. This topic's close to my heart because it's something that I started to realize at a very young age that there was a, you know, shift in our healthcare system that wasn't necessarily a positive shift. And, you know, so there's just tuning in that didn't get a chance to read, we're going to speak about the importance of accountability in our health and our wellness and educating ourselves on the avenues that we seek to receive health care if, you know, we haven't the ability and the means to heal ourselves, which I believe is very possible as well. But if that's the case, then choosing health care providers that mirror our ethics and our principles and, you know, what we want in our life, you know. There's holistic approaches, what, you know, you're seeking, which I believe is, you know, the real answer. You know, make sure when you're seeking healthcare providers that, you know, these healthcare providers are educated and are driven, you know, to teach you and to help you be whole and well and learn about your situation and your body. You know, not just giving you a prescription to heal. Lori, do you want to start off and share a little bit about your experience with the healthcare system and what has driven you to seek out alternative medicine and, you know, educating yourself on your own healthcare and your own well-being?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been kind of battling with it for the last 20 years, actually. I had some diagnosis, and I had some encounters that I had to face head on, which, you know, some of it was just, you know, I was born with, and some of it just, I happened, you know, it happened because of just poor decisions So with that being said, I mean, I had, you know, I did have some really good doctors that gave me some, you know, options, and I never really thought about it. And, you know, at that, during that time of my life, but I looked, as I started doing a lot of research, really wasn't so much, you know, when I started a lot of, on the internet at all, actually, I wasn't even on the internet, but I did a lot of books and everything, and of my choices to change, you know, certain herbs and diets, and even at that time, it was supplements to, you know, and I actually did heal from some of these things that I was experiencing from just changing, you know, going into the holistic choices. So, I mean, just I had some things happen where I reversed it. And the doctors were in, like, amazement. I still had to go. I still had to get checked out. I still had to do, you know, some work and tests. But what, from what my experience was that, you know, some of the doctors that I had dealt with, they really, you know, there was some that was really big on, you know, it's up to you. And then I had those that were just pushing the pill, trying to write off prescriptions every month, and you have to take a pill every day for the rest of your life until you die. And I knew that wasn't true, so I proved that wrong. And that's really one of the biggest things I could share there that's really important, because it is choices. I mean, we all have them. And I believe that there is a certain cure for certain something that's natural that I believe that was provided to us since, you know, the dawn of time, that, I mean, before, you know, the modern day world and everything. I just believe that there's always something that helps create some healing mechanism other than manufactured medicine.
Absolutely. And that's a beautiful story that you shared, and it's really empowering because, you know, I know if we could really literally stop practically everybody in this country, I believe that everybody would have a similar story, you know, some kind of story where they went to seek health care and they didn't get what they needed. You know, they didn't get what they needed and probably felt a little more confused than they were before they even went in. One of my stories, I'll share the most recent one. I've had stories my whole life, but I really believe that that was pushing me to do things like I'm doing today, you know, educating people and then becoming a healer and a health care practitioner myself, you know. So, but recently, over the last year and a half, I, mind you, side story, I had 3 jobs and going to school full time, but I developed vertigo, and I'd never had that in my entire life, you know, and I've always been a really, you know, when it comes to just inner balance, I've always had, you know, great balance and inertia. I've never experienced, you know, that feeling, but I've known people that had, and I know it was, you know, a horrible condition. So, you know, I woke up one morning and I just, everything was spinning, you know, out of control. It was really scary. And, you know, I just tried waiting it out for a few days because I've always been a really healthy person. And if I have anything, it usually doesn't last very long, you know, and I can beat it. But on the 5th day, my friend was just like, if you don't go to the hospital, I'm going to call the ambulance. So I went to the ER and they did a CAT scan. They did all this different stuff. And they told me basically I had positional vertigo, which just didn't resonate with me at all. And it's ironic because I was studying occupational therapy and we had just covered that condition in school. And I was like, you know, that just doesn't make sense to me. So I listened to what they said and took the medication they gave me. And then it was okay for about 2 weeks. And then, boom, it came back. So I waited it out, took the medication, and then, you know, continued on. And then it came back again. And this time I knew that they had it wrong, you know. But I started seeking, you know, figuring out what it could be, you know, what was causing this. So long story short, you know, it was a few months ago that, you know, it came back again. And I just said, you know what, I'm just going to find a nurse practitioner because I really trust that, you know, for all of the healthcare, I believe nurses that start from, they have to go through the whole spectrum. You know, they are connected to their patients and, you know, what they're going through. So I have a lot more trust in nurse practitioners when it comes to Western medicine than doctors. And I found one, and because I just wanted her to tell me that it was an ear infection. I really believed that it was a recurring ear infection that was doing this, but the doctors missed, the ER missed, whatever. And I went to her, and, you know, she finally looked at my ears, and she said, oh, my goodness, you have ear infection. And I said, thank you, you know. And then I proceeded to do some steps to get rid of the ear infection. And what's great is my friend told me about oregano oil, which is a miracle. And that's what got rid of my ear infection, was taking oregano oil and reversing it. So, you know, all of that time of, you know, being confused and misled about an ear infection, what's really funny, about it, is my primary care doctor that I'd been seeing for this wanted to send me to a neurologist. You know, and that's just, that. How funny is that? But that's actually what the next step he was going to do before ruling out an ear infection. He was going to send me to a neurologist specialist. And I just think that that is, it's sad, but I find it really humorous, you know. And thankfully, underneath it all, I didn't believe them, you know, from the get-go. Thankfully, from the beginning, I believed in their ignorance because I just, I see what's lacking in our medicine today on, in this country, you know, is because they don't treat the whole body and they don't treat the system. They treat a symptom and what's occurring on the surface level, you know, and that has nothing to do with what's probably causing it in the first place, you know. And I respect Eastern medicine because not only do they treat the body, they treat the energy systems, they're treating everything, you know, they treat the spirit, they're treating everything all together as a cohesive unit. And to me, that's real medicine, you know. That is real wellness when you're addressing everything. And I'm grateful, you know, to me that that's always made more sense and that I always trust my instincts, you know. But I really do, and, you know, this show is geared to the people, you know, the really elderly population that, you know, feel really powerless and, you know, are turning to their doctors. They're like their fail-safe, you know. Or people that don't have a lot of money or, you know, just don't have the information put out. You know, thankfully I studied massage therapy. Like, I've studied a lot of different holistic, you know, approaches to health and wellness. But for those people that haven't had that opportunity, you know, or that guidance, you know, I really do feel that they need a voice and, you know, they need to hear, you know, their other options and what they can do. Because as this is spinning, and we're going to have Scott talk here in a second about, you know, the business aspect of hospitals and healthcare now and how it really has switched to, you know, when our grandparents were young, you know, doctors came to visit them. Like, they came to their home. They saw how they lived. They knew them on a patient basis, you know, their life. They, you know, to me, that medicine in the past was much closer to, you know, what holistic medicine was, you know. And now it's very superficial, you know, and a lot of doctors, you know, when I would go see a doctor, you barely speak to them, you know. You're speaking way more to the nurse or the medical assistant than the doctor that's coming in. And how much do they know about your backstory? You know, how much questions do they ask? You know, how much do they know about what you do for a living? You know, those things. And as that's shifting even more and more as healthcare, you know, people are becoming sicker because the system doesn't work. You know, they're not teaching people to be well on a whole basis. That's even going to increase, you know, the lack of intrinsic connection with your healthcare providers. It's only going to get stronger, you know, and just speeding up in this desire to make money and not be a patient focus, wellness focus over a money and a business focus. So, you know, the individual's role of becoming aware and educated, you know, in their own healthcare and in their own wellness is becoming a vital importance, you know, and a shift. So I pray for our young people that they grow up knowing that, you know, and educate themselves in that way. So, Scott, would you like to add anything to some of the things we've talked about, or maybe any of your own experience with healthcare and why you
sure.
got into
well,
healthcare,
I think,
like your backstory?
Yeah, I think I first became aware of the business side of healthcare back when my mom was first diagnosed with cancer, and that was breast cancer in 2011, I believe it was. Now, I've been in healthcare my entire life, literally, you know, starting out at 15 as a dishwasher in a retirement village. I got my nursing administrator's license when I was 20. So my early career was spent running nursing homes, home health agencies, the post-acute care side. And then in the late 1990s, I became an administrator with a large healthcare system here in Central Florida and started seeing the hospital side, working with a lot more physicians, things like that. So my mom lived in the Clearwater area, so she wasn't in my particular healthcare system, but I remember going to see her oncologist and talking about his recommendations. And I wasn't quite as sophisticated clinically as I am now, although I'm not a nurse. You know, I've been in healthcare administration now at a pretty senior level, so I'm pretty familiar with the latest diagnostic tools that are out there for imaging and lab and those kind of things. But at the time, I wasn't quite that sophisticated. But, of course, I started researching the latest treatments. And one of the things that was just kind of becoming a little bit more common was doing genetic profiling for your chemotherapy. So right now, there are certain standard treatments that they treat certain cancers with regardless of your genetic profile. For many years, they've done what's called sensitivity testings for, like, effective antibiotics. So certain bugs are more susceptible to others. So it's not a completely new concept. That's been around for a long, long time. But to actually go and once the genetic profile was, you know, had been evaluated, you know, and completely profiled, you can actually take certain cancer medications and see which genetic profile would be most effective for your particular disease. But I remember talking to the oncologist about that, and he just looked at me like, what are you talking about? And I was like, well, I have an article here. I've just been reading it. Oh, no. Because standard protocol is blah, 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 and which he wanted my mom to do radiation, also have surgery to have her lymph nodes removed, bilateral mastectomy, so her breasts and lymph nodes would be removed, and also chemotherapy. So I made sure my mom completely understood what all of those things meant. And she was a smart lady, and she was perfectly capable of making her own decisions. And so her choice at that time was to do surgery. She wanted to have the bilateral mastectomy and the lymphedema. I made sure she understood what that meant as far as when you have your lymph nodes removed, the lymph has nowhere to go, and so your arms become morbidly humongous, and they're not fat. It's just the lymph has nowhere to go. So that's one really downside, which later on was really, really difficult for her. And she did not want chemo, though. She was adamant she didn't want chemo. The oncologist wasn't happy about that because later I realized that's the only way he made his money. He could refer them to, you know, getting the radiation. That's fine, but he didn't make any money on that. He's referring them to another specialist that will do that form of treatment. So that's when it started to glom onto me. It's like, well, why aren't they doing some of these more innovative treatments? It seems a lot more sensible to find out what her genetic profile is and, you know, find out what drugs work. And then as I got into healthcare at a deeper level, at a very senior level in healthcare, I came to realize that, and this is not a knock on saying physicians are unethical or they, all doctors, you know, only do it for money, but their associations come up with certain standard protocols that they supposedly have determined are the best. But coincidentally, most of those standard protocols are also the most profitable. So they're not going against their organization's recommendations on what the most effective treatments are, but they happen to usually coincide with the best reimbursed treatments. And I ran into this later when I was getting my master's degree, and I heard one of the nurses for a large healthcare system, she was a surgical nurse, talking about she had done a study about the most effective treatment forms for lung cancer. And one of the least invasive and most effective was pulmonary ablations. And that's what they basically go through into the lung arthroscopically so they don't have to open up the side of your chest, and either through freezing the tumors, cancer cells, or sometimes they'll use a laser, they ablate them. They basically excise them out of the body. And it's a one-day procedure typically. It's very effective. She had all the studies about the effectiveness of that procedure versus the standard approved kind of protocol. And so she actually came out and said, and I couldn't understand why more and more doctors weren't doing it. And she said, until I realized that there was almost no reimbursement for doing the pulmonary ablation therapy, but there was great reimbursement for doing the whole surgical intervention. And again, it's not like the doctors made this up and said, gee, let's do this. Their protocols, you know, basically said, well, this is more effective. And granted, the pulmonary ablations may have been, you know, more recent types of therapies, but they did not rise to the level of common use, at least not yet, as they are beginning to, as the old or traditional surgeries were. And I don't personally believe that has anything to do with just the effectiveness. I think it's well known what is billable and what's not billable. And that's when I came to understand that it's not always about the most effective treatment or what's best for the patient. It's about what's going to pay you the best. And then I started thinking, you know, this is really not new, because as a kid growing up, I think all of us, you got a sore throat. They went and they took out your adenoids and they took out your tonsils, period, done, end of story. That was like, yeah, one sore throat and that's it, you're done. And I was thinking to myself, and that was really before, you know, insurance was common and, you know, there was no Medicare and all that kind of stuff back then. And I said, boy, they were doing that like automatically even back at that time when, you know, I was a little kid. I remember when I had a sore throat, I begged my parents. I said, I don't want my tonsils out. Don't let them take them out. And I was able to salvage my tonsils and adenoids. Now, I'm not saying it's not effective. My grandson was having real problems with his hearing and with fluid in the ears. And he had his tonsils and adenoids out, and it did clear up the problem. So I'm not saying it's not even an effective procedure, but to throw everybody in the same category, I also found out even back in that day, that was a very profitable procedure relative to the time of just taking out your, you know, a lot of little kids in the early 1960s, you know, let's go ahead and just take out their adenoids and their tonsils, and, you know, there's some, you know, efficacy to it, and we also make some money on it. So, you know, I think that there's a tendency for medicine to lump things together, and whether by design or just a combination of design and the protocols, they happen to be sometimes the most expensive procedures. So, you know, having seen it myself personally at a very senior level of healthcare working with physicians, and also understanding that I'm not saying it's not sometimes justified to go a different route, but it does seem that you get put on the pathway, which often is more invasive and more profitable for the provider, whether it's the hospital, nursing home, home health agency, physician, and those that don't. And it's not new. It may be as bad or worse than it's ever been, but it's certainly not new.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's so great to get, you know, your perspective on that as well. And you know, I wish we could really, you know, have hundreds of people share their story, because I know that there is. You know, I know, interestingly enough, my father, you know, has just been battling cancer, and he's at stage four. You know, stage four, he was in horrible pain, you know, very tired. If I could even tell you, you know, how many different doctors they wanted him to see every week, you know, and driving, and he had to drive an hour each way, you know, to come in. You know, every day, a different doctor, different doctor, different doctor. And we're talking within a block radius of each other, you know. And, you know, he looked at me and he was like, why are they doing this? You know, and I was, and each time a copay, you know, each time a copay, each time a new thing. And I'm very proud of him for, you know, declining on doing chemo because, you know, he was like, I'm done. And he got the surgery, which I'm grateful for, because he definitely needed that. It was at such a progressive place that he definitely, it was what he needed to do. And he decided not to do it, you know, and I respect that, you know, for him, and I respect that he's, you know, trying these other methods. And, you know, but to see what he had to go through, you know, to see them just bouncing him back and forth from doctor to doctor, specialist to specialist, and copay, and it was just, it's a rat race, you know, for people. And when you're in that space of just, you know, needing help, you feel really defeated, you know. It's even more of a defeating process to be going doctor to doctor seeking answers, you know, seeking a solution. And they wouldn't even really do anything. You know, he'd show up, they'd look, they'd write the same things down and send them to the next doctor, you know, all to get a surgery eventually. And I just saw the mundaneness of it, and I saw, you know, that this is just a way of, you know, making sure each doctor gets the money that they need, you know, within their group. And, it, you know, it hurts me to say this out loud, but I really truly believe that. You know, I believe the system's broken. I don't, you know, blame each party. You know, I just think the system has been designed to be broke, you know, to be a broken system now. You know, it's not something that is about, you know, wellness. It is about, you know, teaching your clients how to live better afterwards, you know, how to maybe do some things different. And I don't believe doctors are taught the same way. You know, for me, I would always feel more comfortable going to someone that I know has studied Eastern medicine, studied philosophies of, you know, the body and the energy systems and the anatomy altogether, because I know that doctor is going to take me as a whole person, not just what's going on in one part of my body, but he's going to address everything. You know, he's going to address it all. And, you know, the importance of that is, you know, beyond the scope of just this one radio show. And, you know, people understanding the importance of that and kind of seeing the trends that we've just shared in our different examples in our lives, you know, that that is mirroring what is missing in our healthcare, because the solution now is surgery or drugs, you know, and that really isn't the solution. And it kind of ties, it definitely ties into our last show where Adrienne was speaking about, you know, her specialist telling her that she was going to be on drugs for her life, and she didn't believe them, you know. She refused to believe that, and doing something about it, learning. Go ahead, Scott.
I was going to say, you mentioned the system, and it goes back even further than this in the sense that our entire debt system, our banking system, is geared toward enslaving us all into debt. I mean, that's the fact. I mean, whether nobody makes you take out that loan, but, you know, everybody, you know, can't pay for it themselves. And in healthcare, that's what happens oftentimes, not just healthcare, many professions, but healthcare in particular, because these folks that go into medical school, unless they come from, you know, completely multimillionaire families, which many do not, you know, it costs hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of dollars, not just for the medical school, but then for your insurance and the cost of operating your practice. So now you're saddled with this incredible debt, so you're even more at risk for saying, well, I have to go with these other procedures rather than the ones I might want to go with, because how else am I going to pay my bills? And I'm not saying that doctors make that a conscious decision all the time. I think most physicians and clinicians do, by and large, do what's right for the patient. However, to your point about referrals, they get involved in this networking component where there's nothing wrong with making an oncologist refer to a radiational oncologist. On the other hand, they do it so automatically because they're feeding each other. And, you know, the radiation oncologist will send it back to the regular oncologist, you know, and so on and so forth. And I don't think they get any direct kickbacks or anything. I'm not claiming any of that. But they certainly get the stream, the download stream of those referrals at the expense sometimes of the patient who is continuing to pay those copays. Amazing what happens if that patient has no insurance. They don't get those referrals because they don't have the money, right? So that whole process kind of stops dead in its tracks oftentimes when the patient doesn't have any insurance. But the better insurance you have, the more referrals you're going to be given. And that's just the name of the game. And again, I'm not saying it's inappropriate healthcare treatment, but there isn't it interesting that if you have insurance, you'll be referred everywhere, and if you don't have insurance, you'll be referred nowhere.
Right. My question to you, Scott, is, and to Lori, either one of you could answer this one, is when do you think it shifted from, you know, we know the basis of our Western medicine is Hippocrates, and he is coined with saying, you know, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food, you know, and the idea that the body's natural state of being is wellness, you know, and that it must be an external force or, you know, I would even say internally in our minds as well, you know, creating some kind of dysfunction. So when did it shift from that type of a dynamic and an approach to medicine to the artificial state we have now?
I think the biggest shift, at least in the United States, was when Medicare and Medicaid came around, and that was in the mid-1960s. So, you know, on the surface, the great experiment of getting health care for people. And, hey, you know, my family has benefited from Medicare throughout their lives. And, you know, I think it was probably done, at least at some degree, with the best of intentions. But initially, when Medicare and Medicaid first came out, they couldn't get any doctors to take it because most of doctors, all they had to do is, you know, you go to the doctor, you'd pay your bill, or maybe you had insurance. But for the most part, it was a private paid type of deal for the most. And no, you have to mess with billing forms, didn't have all this extensive staff. So to actually get people to participate in Medicare and Medicaid, the government had to keep making the reimbursement better and better and better. And they're like drug dealers, right? So they cut the heroin down faster and faster and faster to where it's more potent, and then eventually everybody says, I can't afford not to be in Medicare and Medicaid. So you get everybody hooked into Medicare and Medicaid and all the other insurances then that later followed that. And so they started driving the direction of healthcare based on how much money was being paid. And I'm not saying every physician or every provider fell into it, but I saw that trend, and it was a little bit before my time, but as I look back on it from the 80s, how it happened, I saw that trend shifting people into doing processes rather than really evaluating what was right for the patient. In today's day and age, for example, you're lucky. If your PCP will come and visit you when you're out in the hospital, that's a rarity. Your care is usually managed by what's called a hospitalist in the hospital. And they manage your care, but they really don't know anything about you except whatever diagnostic tests they've run. They're not like picking up the phone and calling your PCP. At least typically that doesn't happen that way. So you become kind of a marble, like in the swirling loop. And, you know, you may be getting halfway decent care, but all the different components aren't talking. And one of the opportunities I had with one of the health systems I worked with was creating that continuity of care so that there was a handoff back and forth. And the outcomes were so much superior to it. So in answer to your question, at least in my personal opinion, I think much of it started changing when Medicare and Medicaid came about and it became a bureaucratic process and a billing-driven process and a reimbursement-driven process rather than a focus on the patient's care specifically and best outcome for the patient.
Yeah, I agree. And I like that you brought up, you know, that shift where you spoke about the 60s. You know, if we could probably tie in when this country became really progressively, you know, money conscious and, you know, really driven by that shift, you know, opposed to, you know, our everyday living and, you know, the unity of our country. You know, when we could time that, you know, I bet you that they would correlate very strongly. You know, I bet you it would correlate completely because it's interesting. One of the quotes that stand out for me for Hippocrates, too, is it is more important to know what sort of person has a disease than to know what sort of disease the person has. And,
right.
You know, when we shifted from that connection, that personal connection, because if you look at this country way back, you know, it was really founded on, you know, there were connections like that in a business setting and all across the spectrum, school setting, everything. You know, it was really person to person. Everybody knew each other, and they wanted to. You know, they wanted to have that connection. You know, You know, we shifted to, you know, industrialism. You know, we shifted to, you know, really money consciousness, you know, opposed to personal, you know, opposed to intrinsic connections. You know, you lose that connection. You know, you lose that personal care. You know, you lose that compassion or that desire to have that. So is it coincidental that our medicine became that way as well? You know, our healthcare became that cold, you know, that impersonal, because business became that impersonal. You know, do you think it's coincidental or is it linked?
Oh, I think it's clearly linked. But then you can go back centuries upon centuries and see how the small, richest, smallest minority tried to control the majority. And that trend is no different today. As a matter of fact, Brzezinski, who was Reagan's chief of staff, he said it is easier to kill a million people today than it is to control them. And he actually said that. It's easier to kill a million people today than it is to control them because of the Internet and access to so many alternative forms of media, which they hate, by the way. They love the Internet because they can know everything we're doing. That part they like. they hate the fact that we can actually share ideas that are unique and not go through their corporate-owned media, which is so, I mean, you can tell the difference so easily. So I think that shift has always been in place, but for him to make that comment with so many, you know, more people on the planet than has ever existed at one time before, you know, 7 billion, kind of an ominous statement to say, gee, a few nuclear weapons and we could really cut down on all those people, which are really inconvenient to control. And so I think if you look at all of the different types of shifts monetarily, I mean, even like student debt, I mean, some of these students, I mean, what I teach is healthcare, and I think our students have a better chance to find employment than your typical student. But some of these students are going and get their bachelor's degree, master's degrees in political sciences or some generalities, and they're finding themselves working at McDonald's with debt they can't sustain. There's no way they can ever pay it back. And the government, it doesn't just write it off like it does with other things. Like you can walk away from your mortgage if you can't afford it, and you might not ever get a mortgage again, but you can walk away from it. You can't do that with student debt. So, and there's more, there's over $1 trillion right now in student debt. But how do banks make money? They loan. That's how they make their money. So people aren't buying houses and cars in the quantity they want them to. So let's tell them all, let's go out and get your bachelor's degree and master's degree and whatever foo-foo degree you want. And don't worry, that'll just having the degree will get you a job. Garbage. That doesn't work that way. Even people that have bachelor's and master's in very skilled programs are having difficulty finding work today. So you can take it all back to where it's been for thousands and thousands of years, which is the rich elite, which want to control the debt slaves, and unfortunately that would be most of us.
Right. Absolutely. And that's a whole other show too about, you know, how that's a money making thing, colleges. Lori, what's your take on, you know, some of the stuff, you know, we've talked about going from, you know, the history of this country and to where we shifted?
Oh, yeah, I totally, you nailed a lot of very valuable points, Scott. I totally agree with the direction that we've been heading, and I was really looking at that same time frame, you know, the 60s on until current. I mean, I just saw a just major shift. I mean, a good example, I mean, just to throw that out there, like, there was never, when I was going to school in the 80s, there was never... You see all these behavioral centers now. They never had that when I was growing up. It was, you know, they didn't have, there was no ADHD. Oh, you know what I mean? I just feel it's a business to, you know, for pharmaceuticals and just overall just the insurance, abusing of the insurance, I should say. But that's just, you know, that's my personal belief, just as an example.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we can tie, you know, we've talked about the shift in, you know, industrialized America, and we shifted, you know, to money and, you know, education. So that's put a lot of pressure on doctors and healthcare systems to go with the trend if they don't want to lose out, you know, because they put so much out there, you know, as Scott brought up, to take out these huge loans, you know. And, you know, it's something that I've been really conscious of is navigating, you know, through school and picking and choosing what I want to study, because I don't want to owe $200,000 in student loans, you know, and be forced to have to pay that back and necessarily take jobs or be the kind of health care provider you don't want to be in order to do that, you know. But I think Scott brought up a very valid point that a lot of doctors do find themselves in that space, and having worked in a hospital, you know, for many, many years, you know, I saw people slip through the cracks. I saw, you know, the gaps in our healthcare, you know, and then I also saw that the money that's just tallying up because we're somehow trying to make back, you know, what's missing on the other spectrum, you know, the money that's already missing from the people that aren't insured. You know, you see people paying like $100 for an aspirin, you know, in the ER, you know, the crazy amounts of money that we're charging people, you know, for healthcare now too, to kind of try to make up for what's broken. And, you know, Scott and I have had a lot of discussions about, you know, the business aspect of this country, you know, and the banks and the situations of how, you know, we are just really price gouging, you know, to use a term that's pretty apropos, you know, for what we're talking about, because it is just astronomically off balance, you know, all of it. And, you know, that's the premise of the show for me is the only way for us to balance out our health care is to learn how to be well. And, you know, I think there's a huge shift in wellness now and consciousness with people that they actually want to be. You know, they want to be a part of the process. They want to be a part of their health care and learning about themselves. And I think as a younger generation, that's more, you know, natural. I think for the older generations, I'm not saying everyone, but, you know, the trend, I think it's very, very hard for the older and elderly population to learn to incorporate wellness into their life because it's not convenient, you know, because of the way things are set up now. What's ironic is the way they grew up was very holistic, you know, and very natural. You know, their food was much more natural. The way they ate was much more natural, you know. But it's funny how you can be conditioned through time and into convenience. And now they're, you know, they're kind of lost as to where they fit in. And I think money has a huge, huge play in that as well, because it does cost money to eat well. You know, it does cost money to choose organic over non-organic, you know, or fast food over freshly made food. You know, what are some of your guys' thoughts, you know, on that aspect, you know, how that has a lot to do with, you know, our healthcare system too, what we're eating?
Oh, there's no doubt it's huge. And, you know, people, even regular food, you know, it's funny when you watch the mainstream media, you know, they say, oh, there is no inflation. But people don't understand that the way they calculate the consumer price index, they keep taking things out of that calculation that they don't like. Like things like, gee, we use once in a while, like food is no longer contained in the CPI. Energy, no longer in the CPI. All the things that are going up. So if they don't like the story, they just pull it out of the way and calculate it. And they've done that like 18 times in the last 20 years. So, you know, they can look at the cost of plasma screen TVs, which have gone down, no doubt. But you can't eat one, and you can't use it to fill your tank with gas. And then when you get into the better quality foods, as you're talking about, Carrie, they're going up even that much more rapidly. And, you know, I believe that it's mostly due to a crashing dollar. You know, yes, you can say there's been floods and, you know, there's been that pig virus and stuff going around, but I think it's the crashing dollar. I mean, the dollar is the default currency since the end of World War II. And once we went off the gold standard, the value of that dollar has continued to decline, which causes inflation. But that's not the story that the government wants us to know. So they make up other excuses as to why inflation's going on. This whole thing in Iraq, for example, now they're blaming higher oil prices. Oh, God, it's on that Iraq thing. Really? Huh. It's funny it wasn't happening back when we were over there ourselves. But now, you know, because of the crashing dollar, the price of oil is going up, our fuel is going up, so they have to have something to blame it on. So always look through. Whenever you hear anything on the mainstream media, if it's frontline stuff, look underneath the surface and say, why did they just tell us that? Because I know it wasn't for our own good. So you've got to go,
right,
you know, a couple levels down, then you can figure out the answer, whether it's medicine, whether it's inflation, you know, whether it's some kind of health outbreak. You got to go at least 2 to 3 levels to get the real story. And fortunately, right now we have the Internet that can help find those places through pretty mainstream Internet stuff that's still the real story.
Absolutely, and we're very blessed that way. It's interesting that I love everything you just said, because that's what I believe. You know, it's up to us to be curious. You know, we got to be a little curious. I've always been, I'm grateful to God that ever since I was very young, I was not afraid to challenge and ask questions, you know, whoever it was, you know, whoever it was in my life, whatever authority figure, I would ask why, you know, why is that? And to me, you know, because we've kind of been gearing up to this, I believe, you know, when this country became about capitalism and free enterprise, that's where you're going to see our shift in healthcare, you know, our shift in schooling and education, you know, which directly relates to our healthcare, because you're talking about our doctors and our nurses and all of our healthcare providers, you know, having to feed into that system. And if the government regulated, you know, if something, you know, something should be socialized, education and medicine should not be able to be inflated, you know. If you want this country to have a stable, you know, root and wellness, you know, those things should not be able to be in flux, you know, because they should be about what they're there for, you know, for you to be well, for you to be whole. If you work and you live in this country and you pay taxes, you should be provided the same amount of health care across the board for each person, you know. Same with education. You know, we should have the ability and the rights to make that fair across the board. And the only way that they would have been able to do that is if they regulated it, you know, if they didn't make it a business. But they allowed it to become a business, you know. Our government allowed healthcare and education to become a business. And right there, you've lost any control over, you know, what that means, you know. And we've never been able to catch up because if you look at it in the same way as the gas prices, I mean, you want to talk about inflation, look at our healthcare and look at our education system, you know. So it's scary, you know, but, you know, you have to become curious and really look and say, wow, you know, that's incredible. And, you know, you look at, on the flip side, you know, the farmers that are producing, you know, that are trying to produce food in this country, and the ghastly difference of what a farmer makes opposed to what, you know, a higher educator makes, like admin style, I'm talking, you know, like a dean, you know, of a school or a director. You know what I mean? There's such a complete imbalance of the way the funds are allocated in this country and wages, you know. It's disturbing, you know, but there's never, you know, that's the nature of our system, you know, it's just let out of control, you know, the capitalism in this country. And, you know, I'm curious to know when it shifted, you know, when it shifted from how it was, because it's ironic that this country was kind of founded on the idea that we were going to be different than England. You know, we were going to be different. We were going to be the new world, you know.
And Carrie,
we didn't. Yeah. Go
can
ahead.
I propose something to your question? I don't think it's when it shifted. That's not the question. I believe the question is, when did we start awakening? Because it's not new. I can take you back thousands of years to just a few 60, 70 years ago in the height when we thought America was, you know, just patriotic and rah-rah. And I was one of those people. But then you read about after, you know, during World War II, we were testing the H-bomb. Right after World War II, we'd march our troops right through a radioactive zone, you know, back when we were might is right and we were the good guys, right? We would march them through a radioactive zone just to see what happened to them. Or the Tuskegee Airmen that we were, or the, they were in Tuskegee, Alabama, they weren't the airmen. Tuskegee guys that thought they were being treated for syphilis and they were just pretending to see what would happen if they didn't treat them. You know, those kind of stories have existed for centuries. What's different is when did we start awakening? When did we as a population in the world start awakening? And I think that's really been within the last, maybe going back to the, you know, the 60s and the age of Aquarius and, you know, before my time, but certainly in the last 20 years, you know, we're beginning to awaken and ask these questions. And I can promise you the elite does not like that. That's why the NSA monitors every call that they can possibly have, as I'm sure they're monitoring all of these, not listening to them, but at least mining the data. So if they ever want to go and look up, let's say Carrie is one day, you know, a senator, and she's going to vote on an important bill, and they pull up this car and say, boy, you didn't really believe much in the government at that time. Would you like us to release that information or just vote the way we want you to vote? That's the real danger of this huge mass collection, and that's what they've been doing. But it's no different than what Hoover did back in the FBI when, you know, he'd infiltrate these human rights organizations and get some dirt or somebody's having an affair. And, you know, this is not new. The question is, when did we start awakening?
Yeah, but see, it's funny that we can go back, and when I think of when this country was, you know, more balanced, I'm going back, you know, Little House on the Prairie style, you know what I mean? That's where my mind's going back because, you know, by the time, you know, when we got industrial, that's when we shifted, you know, so, you know, by 50s, 60s, you know, 40s, mid-40s, we were already shifting that way, you know, and it shows how we dropped, you know, the Depression is a great example of how it bottomed out because we were already starting on the wrong path. You know, we were already starting on the wrong path and the wrong approach, you know, in the sense where it was I, self, and me, no longer a we consciousness. You know, so yes, we're reawakening to the fact that, you know, we used to live more in connection. You know, we used to live more in that we consciousness, that connection. And I agree with you. I agree with you that they don't want us to wake up, you know, because
well,
you're going to be taking power away from people.
Just
sure.
one more addition to that, though, is I believe today that the vast amount of humanity are good, wonderful spiritual people. And I believe the vast amount of humanity 2,000 years ago, or Little House on the Prairie days, were vast, wonderful people. Same percentages. I don't think we are, as a percentage, any better or worse necessarily. Maybe today we're even better if you look at the whole the super number. But what was reported? Let's think about Little House on the Prairie days. Well, we were slaughtering Indians left and right. Not most of us, but we were taking all their lands away. We were slaughtering them. We enslaved, bazillions of blacks. We were doing atrocities, but it didn't make the mainstream media, right? Only historians later came out and actually identified these things. Remember that wars are written by the people that win, not the people that lose. So I think these same atrocities have been happening forever, but it was easier to control, 100 newspapers than it is to control 7 billion people going on the Internet today. And I think, as we become more interconnected, and I think it's beyond just the Internet, I think spiritually we are becoming more interconnected. So we're even getting beyond the Internet. We won't need the Internet so much. We're going to be so interconnected, we'll be able to look at each other and maybe not hear the thought directly, but certainly get toward that point.
Exactly, because we're going back to that connection of all us, the we, not the I. And it's funny, the reason I bring up, how things were, when you go pilgrim, that's not even that far in the past, is, these people that were raised that way. So our grandparents, our great-grandparents, it's amazing to me. It does show the power of influence, how you can forget your roots, because they were very, very holistic back then, very natural, very organic. And it shows you the power of influence, and it shows the importance of remembering, the roots and what we're able to do and what we're able to live on, how we're able to be natural, and how we're able to be connected and to reawaken to that, because it's not something that is new. It is, we've lived that way before, And ironically, if you really, since you brought up the Indians, it doesn't surprise me that they eradicated them, because they didn't want us to know, that they were showing us how to live that way. They lived that way for hundreds of thousands of years, without ever needing to industrialize their life, to live that way. And, inside there's a natural calling and awakening to return to that for people, to return to simplicity, to return to the connection of Earth and honoring Earth and respecting what we have and being grateful for what we have. And, to me, that's our reshift, our reawakening, is to go back to that. And when it shifted to, the singular person, capitalism to me is, singularity, individualism. When we shift from that to caring and consciousness and compassion and caring as a whole, how we're progressing together, that's the love, that's the caring, and that's the best thing we can do for ourselves and for each other. But doing, we're very lucky that we have these types of, forums right now to share our experiences with each other and our hope and our strength and our information to help each other be aware, because, it's become our responsibility, for ourselves and for each other, because you can't rely on it coming from the government or the newspaper or, all the naiveties that people have, learned to give over. I would also say our older generation, really are stuck there and believe it. And thankfully, if we learn to be a little curious and seek for ourselves, like you said, Scott, there's a lot of information out there that is contradictory to what we're being told, And for some people, and I've had conversations, with a lot of elderly people, and, sometimes they're receptive, and sometimes it's really hard to get through because they're so programmed to believe, what they're being told, unfortunately, that, they can't see that it's an illusion, So it is really, I feel, whether I can change their minds or not, if I'm shifting, if I'm doing all I can to help myself and other people, that's the best way I can help them, it's the best way I can help them shift. But it's amazing that, to me, if they look back on their life, they really came more from what we're going back towards. They really came from that space it really shows me the power of influence, you know, and the power of the media and the power of the government, that, you know, how much they're really, you know, making them blind. And it's important not to get angry at them, you know, because they're just lost. You know, they just can't see it. It's not resonating.
I think you're spot on, and I think, you know, especially the seniors were taught, don't ever question the doctor. They went to school, and, you know, they know what they're talking about. But that's certainly changing for people of our age. And even some of the seniors are getting it, and they're asking more questions. And even they are using the Internet, and I think it's a very healthy thing. I think most doctors do, too. Some of them look at it as a pain in the butt. But I think by having a better educated client out there, patient out there for them, I think most of them are accepting it. Those that were just churning and burning for less than ethical reasons hate it. But that's not the vast majority of physicians and clinicians out there. They do, I think, generally want to provide the best care, and they recognize that the system, you know, reimburses for the number of people they see each day, not the quality of the people that they see each day. And they don't like it either, but they're doing the best they can to survive and balance the two together.
Absolutely. I agree with that, because I have the pleasure of working with some amazing doctors. And once you start working, you know who's vibrating in that space and who's vibrating in the other space that you mentioned. But it's great, too, because there's a lot of, you know, school systems out there and a lot of, you know, medical systems out there that are promoting complementary medicine and are promoting holistic medicine, you know, and it, you know, that's part of this show, too, is to make people aware that it's your option. You know, you can find it if you're looking, you know, and if that's your intention. Because, you know, Phoenix, the University of Phoenix, great complementary medicine and integrative medicine, you know, program. So, you know, the knowledge and the awareness is out there, and they're trying to spread. But it isn't easy to spread into a system that's geared against that, you know. So I agree with you that, you know, the passion, you know, like Hippocrates' throat, you know, that Hippocratic oath, you know, that's the foundation of Western medicine. You know, that was the foundation. And I believe a lot of physicians really want that, you know, and really come into the healthcare system, you know, with that in mind and with that belief. But when, you know, they enter into the system, they're not in control of the system. You know, they're not in control of that hospital or, you know, what their practices are and what their ethics are. And I think that's got to be a really uncomfortable situation, you know, for them to be in, you know, an uncomfortable relationship and trying to do the best that they can with what they've got. And, you know, it's probably a really common factor of, you know, when a physician starts and then 20 years later, you know, kind of the passion or the energy they have from having to be in a system like that for so many years. But I think a lot of them are responsible for the shift that's occurring in the medical system and complementary medicine that's happening, you know, because they have seen what's missing and, you know, they're trying to compensate for that and to actually, you know, allow people to become connected to their bodies and connected to their wellness and their health. Because that's important. And I think, you know, also if we want to bring it up, I think people were a lot more accountable for their health and back in the day, you know. They tried what they could to heal themselves, you know what I mean? And today I think people don't take that responsibility like they could, you know, and like a lot of us are doing, you know. And it is important to put it, you know, back on ourselves too. Is you're responsible for knowing your own body and what's normal for you, like natural, I should say. You know, and what you're feeding yourself and what you're doing and your stress levels and your job. And, you know, there's so many things that you can do to be well today. You know, there's so many avenues and ways to let that in your life. You know, as you brought up, Scott, like Internet, you can pull up a meditation in seconds on YouTube, you know, or on the Internet. Or, you know, natural foods and recipes for low fat and, you know, organic. You know, you can go to our store and buy organic. You know, that every store will have organic groceries in it, you know. So it is part of our responsibility as people, you know, to really bring that into our lives too. Lori, well, how do you feel? What are your thoughts on that, you know, about whether people have been taking responsibility for themselves as well? How has that fed into the way things have played out?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel that's a huge part. And, you know, speaking from my experiences, because I've shifted into that. I've been doing this for a while. I mean, not 100% on everything, but, and, you know, you brought up earlier, you and Scott were mentioning just even the price of groceries, organic versus the regular stores. One of the Whole Foods that I go into, you know, I calculate pretty much what I spend a month. And it's really for what I buy, which is, you know, 100% of my produce I get from the Whole Foods, is really, it's a little bit more, it's not much more. And I would, and you know, the way I look at it is this. I would rather spend a couple $100 more a month and, you know, knowing that I have a natural cure for something that's very simple than, you know, have to go to the hospital later on and spend thousands and there's no cure. So, I mean, that's just from the experience I've had and, you know, the alternatives that I've chosen and some of the cures that I've experienced, I just totally, I agree it was because of my choices and, you know, getting better educated on, you know, what I could do, what I needed to do for me. So it's definitely, I feel, a big part of everyday living.
Absolutely. Scott, how do you feel about that?
I couldn't agree more. I certainly invest the additional dollars in quality foods, but I do recognize that, you know, when you have the means to do it, even if you're not independently wealthy, it's still different than if you're bringing up four kids and you're on, you know, food stamps. There are still better ways to do it, absolutely, and I think some people make that effort, but it's a little more challenging, I think. When they have less education, they don't understand the value. They're just trying to, you know, get past the day. And I think the other thing that frightens me a little bit, even about great companies like Whole Foods and everything else, you know, between the Gulf oil spill and the co-exit that they used to sink all the oil so we didn't see it, and Fukushima, I really believe that there's a lot more going on with food than we realize. I truly believe the reason Darden sold off Red Lobster is because Red Lobster knows what's going on in the Pacific, and it's not pretty. And so I think, and you know, not that Whole Foods or anybody would hide that from us, but who knows what's really in what we used to think was, you know, wholesome food. And, I mean, there are more and more children dying in Fukushima every day after they said, it's safe, come on, can you come back to Fukushima, it's safe? Of course, you don't hear about it in the mainstream media, and especially since Abe, the president, passed a law that it was illegal for media to report on anything the government said was could harm, you know, public trust. Well, that's pretty much censorship any way you want to. And I think it was largely done because of Fukushima. Because if everybody was concerned about all the Pacific salmon, what would happen? People would start buying different things and ask more questions, and that's the last thing they want us to do.
Right. Totally agree.
But it is what it is. You got to eat, so radioactive or not.
And it's about knowing, you know, your own means and taking it all into, you know, awareness of what you can do, you know. And I also believe it's the intention you put behind stuff, you know. And I think there's always a way, you know, to make little changes in your world. Something also that was awesome that Hippocrates said was, a wise man should consider that health is the greatest of human blessings and learn how by his own thought to derive benefit from his illnesses. And that, to me, that just says responsibility right there with ourselves. You know, and looking at our lives and, you know, what we can do within our lives and start with those small changes, even start with that walking every day, you know, making sure, even if you can't buy organic vegetables, just getting vegetables, cleaning them really good. You know, I do Reiki, so I Reiki my food, you know, I Reiki my food before I eat it. And, you know, I don't always buy organic everything, you know, but I eat a lot of vegetables. I try to eat 80% vegetables in my diet, opposed to, you know, 80% of just carbs, you know, and fillers. And I think a lot of our society, you know, that's kind of what they, you know, a lot of people are eating way more fillers than, you know, natural food, you know, food that's grown and just in its natural state. And, you know, I think that's a huge part of being well, because if our body's alive, you know, our body's a live organism. You know, if you're feeding it food that's not alive all the time, I mean, how alive is your body going to be? You know, how much vibration is coming into your food? You know, that's the key. You know, and that's what resonates for me. And, you know, I follow that. And over the past few years, you know, that's really what shifted in my diet. That's made such a huge difference. Because I used to have heartburn all the time. I used to have chronic heartburn. And I thought it was coffee, so I stopped drinking coffee. You know, and I thought it was just gluten, and gluten had a lot to do with it. But, you know, I stopped eating gluten, and I was still getting it. And then I stopped eating so much meat, and it went away, you know. So, you know, that was huge realization for me, you know. And I was, you know, a big meat eater. Lori, did you have a similar experience?
I was diagnosed with GERD, okay, back in, I don't know if you're familiar with GERD. It's a severe form of acid reflux, and to where it was literally launching me out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I was given a yellow, red, and green light list from my doctor, and never sent me home with Nexium, though, but it was all about diet. And when I made changes, you know, no red, because I was really fanatical at that time. You know, I drank beer, I drank Mountain Dew, I was eating Italian food like it was, you know, going out of style. So I had to take a step back and just evaluate. I'm like, what am I doing? I'm hurting myself physically. So as I made those changes, and it was not easy for me, but I made it easy because it was either this, I have to do this, and suffer, and it gets worse and causes more damage, esophagus damage and whatnot, and later on could even turn cancerous. I, you know, immediately, as soon, within a week and a half, 2 weeks of making those changes, I went back to the doctor, and the esophagus can heal itself. That's what I've learned. So just, I followed the diet plan, and for a long time. I'm not going to say I didn't slip here and there, but for the most part, just as an example, I did it. But also, too, another point that you brought up, talking about the foods. I mean, everything's so fast-paced now in such a rat race. I was looking in the store the other day thinking about our show that we're going to do, and I was looking around, and I'm seeing everything is ready to eat, prepared, all these chemicals in it. And, you know, somebody made a post the other day, or, you know, instead of counting calories, why don't you count the chemicals? You know, and it's a very valuable point to me. So that right there is huge, because you know, everybody's body chemistry is different, first of all, and we react differently. Some can, have effects a lot quicker than most. But compared to when I was a lot younger, I had to peel my own carrots. I had to cut my own celery. I had to, you know, break out the pots and pans, and you know, that's where you got all the vitamins and all the nutrients, basically. Everybody that I grew up with up north, everybody was growing their own vegetables. So, and we did talk about that on last week's show somewhat. I believe Adrian brought that up, not to go too off subject. But, I mean, it's all, you know, rolls into, you know, taking accountability for, you know, alternative choices to prevention of, you know, getting stuck in the health care if you don't have to. I mean, there's some situations where you have to. The choice.
Absolutely, and, you know, it really does come back to self-awareness, you know, self-awareness, consciousness, and, you know, our unity consciousness and what we have and what we learn and we share, you know, like what we're doing today, wanting to share, you know, wanting to share what we've learned, wanting to share what's helped us, you know, what's helped us feel wonderful and healthy. And there are so many avenues to that today. You know, there's so many ways that we can do that and help each other and promote that, because every time we take that step in that direction and in that consciousness and that connection, we're being a part of that shift. You know, we're being part of that, you know, loving shift of wellness and wholeness and unity, opposed to, you know, that ism, you know, the I, self, me, and being stuck and being powerless, you know, because there are so many options today. You know, there's so many different ways that we can start to incorporate what we can do in our lives, and it doesn't have to be, you know, strict. You can start, you know, you can start wherever you're at and do the little things. You know, and we did touch on that last week, Lori, absolutely. You know, the different things that we can do in our lives now to start to promote wellness And, you know, the beginning, you know, the first step is knowing that you can. You know, the first step is having that accountability for yourself and the responsibility to start doing that. You know, start doing that in any form you can in your life. Be if it's just you get up. If you're not ready to change your diet, you just get up at least once a day and go for a walk, you know, around your neighborhood. And not even that, the exercise you're getting, but you're connecting with the people around you. You know, you're connecting with life. You know, and that's another huge aspect of being well, you know, of really engaging in your life and your surroundings and with each other, you know, to shift into more of a connection to who we are at the core of who we are, you know, and which is energy and light and love, you know, and spreading that with each other. Do you guys want to share something you do in your life to, you know, really enhance that feeling and that feeling of wellness for yourself?
Go ahead, Lori.
Basically, I mean, I go for my beach walks. I go for, you know, I do a lot of things around water that help me. I believe I talked to you about this or mentioned that several times. That's really my main source that helps me. I feel that I get a lot of good, and I just feel the energy is more uplifting for me, and it raises my awareness on a lot of things, you know, the energies that I'm around.
Absolutely. That's perfect, because you've shared so many times that it's such a high vibration that it automatically rubs off. You know, it automatically entrains in your energy and raises up yours. And that's a perfect example of what you talked about with the chemicals, too, because if you think about how many chemicals you put in your body, it's changing your vibration. You know, everything we put in our body adds to our vibration. So if it's sunlight, if it's the ocean, or if it's toxins, you know, it's the same thing. We have to become aware of that, you know, that's actual truth.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's funny because as I was having, and shame on me, my iced coffee last week, I kept hearing Adrian say, "Would you like a shot of coffee with that pesticide?" then I just put it down. I was like, "No, done. I'll have an ice water, please."
Awesome, girl. I love you. That's perfect. Shot of coffee with a pesticide. Thanks, Adrian. We're coining that phrase from now on. Sorry, Starbucks.
That's right. Now Adrian's made us all feel guilty for the rest of our lives. No, she was brilliant. She was brilliant and gave a lot of great ideas. I try to get out with nature as much as I can. I try to walk down to the lake, both for the exercise as well as to be by the lake and be by nature. And also in my prayers every day, or my gratitude I give to God every day, is saying affirmations like it's already happened. Like, I'm grateful for the healing of my leg and my arm, and I'm grateful for, you know, the health that I've been provided, as it has already happened, rather than praying, God, I hope you will help me heal, you know, that type of thing. So turning it around, that certainly has helped. What I can do a better job with is, you know, I can eat even healthier. You know, I think I eat lean, but I do still eat meats. I haven't weaned myself away from that yet. And yet, if I had to kill an animal, I would definitely be a vegan. There's no doubt about it. So you know, those are the things that, you know. But I think we balance those things with the stress in our lives, you know. And I haven't gotten away from, if I've had a really stressful day on Friday, I'll have a glass of wine. And, you know, I'm not there yet, but I'm not going to feel guilty about it. It is what it is. And, you know, we are all on our own growth path, and, you know, certain things we're farther beyond than others.
Absolutely. And it's important to remember, go ahead, Laura. Sorry, I was just going to say, you know, everyone is on their own timeline and what feels comfortable. And it doesn't take drasticness to do just little things that feel good in our own lives. Are you going to share something, Laura?
Scott mentioned about the meat and everything. I really don't eat a lot. I don't eat any red meat at all. I do eat a lot of fish, shellfish. Not so much anymore since what happened, you know, listening to, you know, some of the things reading on the internet and some of the radiation that they had found off the, you know, West Coast. So I, you know, My tilapia has been sitting in my fridge for a week. I won't cook it. Thank you, Scott. But I just believe, though, I mean, some of the changes, though, that I've made, not just in that, but sugar was a big one for me. And the things, you know, the things, everything, the gluten, that, you know, anything that produces sugar. So that has the high fructose syrup, everything. I read my labels when I shop. So I'm very conscientious now. And, you know, it has changed a lot of things in me, starting with sleep. It's a very good, you know, between caffeine and sugar that, I mean, I was getting uninterrupted sleep. So, you know, that right there also helps focus. And when you're focusing more, that the more, you know, the higher metabolism. You know, so you can, you know, whatever your goal is, I feel that that's a huge thing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And everything we've really discussed today, you know, there's something's going to resonate to everybody that is more of a challenge in their life or more of a predominant thing, you know, that they could address, you know, and it's just taking that one little step, you know, that one little choice of intention. Like my first one, the first one I did was getting rid of a lot of caffeine, because I noticed that was making my life very anxious. And like you spoke about, you know, having insomnia and all that, like that was directly correlated to me, because when I really limited my caffeine, I started sleeping better at night. You know, I started having a lot less stress, being a lot less in my head. You know, and I was just over-consuming caffeine because I was so busy, and I thought that was my answer, you know. And, you know, I took that away, and it really helped in so many ways. And it definitely wasn't easy, but it was the one thing I started with, you know, and I just started with that one thing. And then I noticed how much more energy I had from that. And I know you have similar experience with that, Lori, right?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, yeah. But, yeah, my energy level shot up in so many ways when I, one of them was just drinking, I just flushed my system with water for, you know, I just drink water. I was using some of the water. I don't have to use water enhancers. That's one thing. And what's helped me, too, is working in the hospitality industry in a very hot kitchen. made me want water more. So, I mean, that, Lori doesn't go without her H2O, that's all I'm saying. But I definitely, that helps keep you cleansed, you know, or flushes your system out from many toxins, actually. But I just watch my intake now, very conscientious about it. I've just noticed somebody, like, sleeping and just getting up and not feeling so groggy in the morning, just having a routine and starting with, you know, waking up and being grateful and instead, you know, with prayer, you know, or talking as if things have already happened. Like you mentioned, Scott, you nailed some really good points there. And I found myself doing the same thing because I always didn't do that. I've been doing this, practicing that, I should say, for the last 5 or 6 years now.
You know, I was going to add one more thing that we talk about. You know, we're on a different path and how far on the journey. And I recall back, you know, what happened for the Buddha. You know, the Buddha was born into a very privileged life, a very wealthy family. And in his early years, he did every type of extreme thing that, you know, the lifestyles of the rich and famous did today. And when he decided he wanted to find God, he went to the opposite. He lived the most austere life and was actually highly respected by the other monks because they were austere, but he was even more austere. He had gotten down his weight just above the point of death. And when he actually reached true enlightenment, he realized it was not the extreme of either. It was the balance between. And as we were talking, you know, I keep thinking about, you know, I need to get better about what I eat. And it's like, but we're on that area of finding balance. Now, having a glass of wine is not necessarily bad. Going out and having a case of wine is not exactly balanced. So, you know, it's those type of things to find the balance in between and in everything in our lives, not just, you know, nutrition, but everything we do is that balance point. That's medication. You know, you take too much medication, and that doesn't necessarily help. You take too little, doesn't help. You've got to take just the right amount. So I just wanted to throw that out there because that's something that's an important component on all of our journeys that I think we need to keep in mind.
Yeah, that's really what wellness is having a balance. You know, homeostasis is a balance of all your systems, all of your energy, you know, mind, body, spirit, you know, and mental. So there's, and that comes back to accountability, you know, is knowing yourself. So let own self be true. Only you can know what you need. Only you can know what's missing. You know, only you can know what feels right. Only you can know what makes you happy. Only you can know, you know, what you really feel. And by sharing this today, you know, that is really what the premise of this show was, to be accountable, to be responsible for yourself, you know, and to learn that. And it can be a beautiful journey, and I love that, you know, Hippocrates said that in the past. You know, it can be a journey of awareness. It can be a journey. Your illness can be a journey into who you really are. It can be a journey into what you are and what you really want to be. And, you know, that's a beautiful thing that we're all here to share. And I know we're coming to the end, and I just want to thank you, Scott and Lori, for just always making my Mojo Monday start off in such a beautiful way. Thank you for a great show and some great ideas that we've tossed around and sharing your experience and your hope today.
Well, thank you both as well. It's always fun.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. You're awesome.
You as well. Look forward to meeting you in person one day.
Oh, yes. We will do so.
And thank you, Lori. I'm so, you know, it's been such a journey and a blessed journey to be such close friends and to see what, you know, both of our paths of health have grown. And, you know, I'm so amazed by you and inspired by all you do in your life as well.
Well, thank you. And same here, my friend. Absolutely. You've taught me many things. And I feel all of us are teachers when I usually say that. I do feel that.
Absolutely. And hopefully, you know, if it's meant to be, we've inspired people today to you know, make the little changes that we chose to make in our lives that have made such a huge difference in both of our lives. So I wish that for everyone that's listening today. It's just one little step in knowing what your happiness is and, you know, what you really feel inside your energy. So thank you all. Much love and blessings and happy Mojo Monday to everyone listening and that brought all their energies to the call and everyone who isn't. May their light shine in the universe.
Thank you, dear. Have a blessed Monday, Mojo.
Much love, darling. Namaste. Thank you.
Namaste.